Access number 27804, squadron leader Ian Blair, Real 17. Now, what was the next phase? You're working on the Oxford.
We're doing the usual things that one had to do, even with taking off, and there was a great concentration on asymmetric power, obviously, for obvious reasons. We'd done precautionary landings. That's where you come in with a lot of power on, and not enough. The attitude of the aircraft is very nose high, so that if your engine hiccups, you're in danger. But that was making short landings, and then a lot of instrument flying. Some accompanied and some not accompanied. Straight and level, and it seems to be all the same thing. And so having medium climbing turns, just looking. Yeah. We did a cross country trip as well. That was the beginning of our training into.
Were there any problems with cross country flying in the Oxford?
Except that, yeah.
In the desert.
The lack of landmarks is a big problem. Yeah, I'll tell you a tale about that later on. Coupled with the flying, we were doing a lot of concentration of ground instruction, such as, apart from the radio, weapons, we're doing navigation, classroom navigation, and so on, things like that, to get you familiar with using your charts and so on and so forth, and how to prepare your log. We even did some night flying, I see. We did solo night flying, actually, on March the 6th. So that wasn't very long after we got there. but it was an experience. The old part of the training. Blind takeoff, I see here. That was when you were shut in complete and told to take off on instruments. That was quite hairy, quite exciting. Then we did a low fire insertion too. That was interesting. And that's, of course, in the desert you can really get low. This guy was outstanding.
Tell me about your instructor. What was his name? What was he like?
He was a very quiet guy, very thorough, very pleasant chap. Didn't shout. He was a flight sergeant when eventually he was elevated to warrant officer. He was obviously he's been flying so many years, but he had a way of teaching you. It taught all the same way, but it's just that he put it across so much simpler, and he would show you the error of your ways, which was always. We even went formation flying, I see, in a twin engine aircraft. You hardly see the wingtips, but it was all part of the working up to the intermediate stage. Don't forget, this is the intermediate stage, not the advanced stage. So, my colleagues in the single engine were doing the same thing in there. They had odd axes. Yeah, we did a lot of formation flying, actually. But there came a time when we had this confrontation, chief flying instructor. He had a go. He took me up April 1st. Wing Commander Ling was the chief flying instructor. Oh, tingling. He got shot in the backside, actually, at the war problem, when we had this minor confrontation. He was flying an Audax, I think it's something. Anyway, so to cut a long story short, we were doing formation flying and all the relevant things, and the 12th of the 4th, January, that was April, we were given the endorsement, certified and qualified, with the wear flying badge with effect from. That's the ultimate.
That's at the end of the intermediate course,
That was the end of the intermediate course. Subsequently, they didn't do that. Subsequently, they didn't do it until the end of. But that was this. That was qualified for the award of the flying badge, which goes on your records in accordance with Quinn's regulations in ACIs, and it says average as a pupil. Well done. By that time, what did I have? I had only had about 30 hours day and 32 hours dual, so that's 60 hours on the Oxfords. At that juncture in May, this Rashid Ali guy enters the theme and enters the situation, and we got, perhaps we should break there, because that's going to be a...
Well, it's difficult with the tape.
All right, well, fair enough, you tell me. Rashid Ali, there was a coup d'etat, and he overthrew the Iraqi government of the day, and Rashid Ali, who was a former president, and a very pro-German, pro-Italian, took over the government. And the king, a boy king then, was evacuated from... But there was an ultimatum served on 4FTS Habania by the Iraqi army. The army moved into the vicinity of the airfield and they approached the main gates, literally, and said, stop all flying. The AOC at the time, who had been... or was in communication with the British government, who weren't all that keen, literally, on giving them any assistance whatsoever. He was between the devil and deep blue sea because he didn't know what to do with this ultimatum. Anyway, eventually, there was also a confrontation going on because the headquarters controlling 4FTS had been passed to India only a couple of months before, and the guys in Egypt didn't want to know because it had gone to India, and India didn't want to, wasn't getting any help from anywhere, and we were there in limbo, and so the guy, the governor, even in Baghdad, was in touch with UK, and more or less, the history shows that I think Churchill said. I think it's recorded, said, if you have to fight, fight, or words to that effect. So the poor old AOC, who suffered a breakdown in the end, not surprising because it was going back and forward. But so the Iraqi army, having moved in and taken post, I should say that they dug themselves in round the airfield at ground level. And there was overlooking the airfield, there's an escarpment which is about 300 feet high, which overlooked the airfield, and they positioned their artillery up on this escarpment. And of course, the hangars were at right angles to this escarpment. And so when the balloon finally went up and they started shooting, as soon as we opened the hangar doors, they used to let fly with the artillery, which wasn't very pleasant, but there was nothing we could do about it. But things were done. What happened was that they mustered all the aeroplanes they could get and all the staff pilots who they could muster, and a few of the student pilots who were above average types, and they armed up the Audaxes with front guns and Lewis guns in the back and bombs and any other aircraft that they could hang weapons on, which were very few Audaxes. The Oxfords, all the Oxfords had was we had some makeshift bomb racks, no, makeshift fittings for bomb racks made, and they hung eight 20-pound fragmentation bombs on the Oxfords. And I'd just come off the desert, so when they called for volunteers, I didn't take a step forward. I just stood my ground, and anyway, I should have been, I suppose, with my with my bombing experience, been in the lead, been in the bomb. But somebody else volunteered for that, and he got the job. I think his name was Meadows, actually. And one or two of the students went as gunners in the back of the, and we were relegated to digging slit trenches and that type of ilk, refueling aircraft and mustard. Anyway, when the word came down to, if you have to fight, fight, the third ultimatum that was delivered, the AOC, I suppose, said in as many words, belt up, we have a right to be here because of the treaty allows us to carry on with our training. And so we will carry on with our training. So that was the sort of attitude. Now, having said that, the ploy was that we would make the first offensive strike at first light the following day. So all the aircraft were all behind the hangars, out of sight, and facing the airfield, and there's these big gates. They mustered all the Audaxes and a few Oxfords, and I think it was, I can't remember which squadron, but there was a Wellington squadron came up from Basra, I think it was. They flew up, and they were the first, dropped the first offensive strike. It was prearranged. They dropped the first bombs on the Iraqi gun emplacements. And under cover of this bombardment, we launched all our Audaxes and Gladiators in this semi-darkness, because there was students and all, and off they went, and they dive-bombed and strafed all the artillery pieces that they could see and played merry havoc with the Iraqi army, which was didn't take too kindly to that, obviously, but they were on a hiding to nothing. Anyway, we really did this. The only there was a few casualties, but the main casualty was that there was a Wimpy was hit and made a forced landing on the aerodrome, and we went out to try and retrieve this. No, I didn't, but somebody did. Went out to try and retrieve this Wimpy, and its engines were stopped, and it stuck on the runway out on the airfield. The tractor went out. The Iraqis fired three shells, one over, one under, and by the third one, the guys had got out of it smartly, but it was hit on the third shot. We couldn't do anything about that. We just hightailed it back into the compound. But all these aircraft came back, and I was supposed to be refueling. Because at Oxford, and I, whilst this was going on, because they dropped their bombs and got shot up, they got badly shot up, actually. There's a lot of small arms fire, but a lot of unsalvageable aircraft. But we taxied them in behind the hangars to screen them, but it couldn't be seen. Plus the fact that in the interim period, where the race course was in the middle of the camp, they'd chopped down all the trees and shrubs and leveled the between the roads and made an airstrip so that the Audax could come in and land out of artillery range, which they did, and we worked. But whilst I was sort of trying to keep, you know, head above water, literally, and getting in these slit trenches, one of the Gladiators, intercepted a Savoia of the Iraqi Air Force, which was only flying about 10,000 feet above, dropping bombs. And this Gladiator, when I attacked it, I remember it quite clearly, actually, and I could hear the guns fired, pop, 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 and stopped. And I thought to myself, that's not very good. I was an armourer. I could be well employed looking after the Gladiators. So, I mean, obviously, I knew instantly that what had caused it was stoppages. So I disengaged myself, and I hightailed it up to the polo pitch, and I, as a corporal, I literally took over the armament for the four Gladiators that we had. And, we were sheltering, and we were belting up the ammunition. I mean that. It didn't come belted in these days. We were belting it up on the officer's mess veranda, you know, in the shade, and we'd no, we had very little ball ammunition. We'd nearly all tracer, so we're better than nothing. So I got out and I got these guys going. Incidentally, there was an air raid and came across and dropped a few bombs on the polo pitch and did a bit of damage and destroyed a couple of aircraft. But I thought to myself, I'll look after these gladiators. So I had these four, stripped all the weapons out of the gladiators. And I've never seen guns like it in my life. The bullets were struggling to get out, literally struggling to get out of it. Because the four gladiators had come from the desert, and they were clapped out when we got them. In fact, the fabric on them was so bad that one gladiator tried to attack a Heinkel, and he went in a screaming dive after this Heinkel and stripped all the fabric off the main planes. That's how bad it was, off the top surface. But it got back to base. But the weapons on these gladiators were rubbish. So I got the few guys I had, we belted up the ammunition, we cleaned out all, took all the guns out of the aircraft one by one and breached them up, as the phrase goes, and cleaned them up and put them back again and harmonized the gun sights. We had to do this with a tail on the ground, unfortunately. We had to imagine, put a board, you know, we used actually the vertical radio masts to line up the guns and made an estimate 300 yards and all that business. Dollar of estimation, but we did it and belted up. But unfortunately, as I said, we only had tracer ammunition. Didn't have any ball, very little ball. So we belted the guns up with four tracer and one ball as opposed to four balls. However, we got them going, and the staff pilots that were flying them didn't do too badly. So on the second day, in between times, we'd get attacked. We'd get strafed by ME-110s, because by this time, the Luftwaffe had sent a detachment to Mosul. And they would come over, they'd send these Heinkel 111s over the camp in broad daylight, no ACAC, nothing like that. And they'd just lay a stick of bombs down the across the camp, or whatever it happened to be. But that was on one of these occasions, one of the gladiators was up and made an attempt, but he didn't. He damaged it, and it force landed in the desert some distance away. But
and this is Heinkel.
Heinkel. But I mean, it was a dot. There was no opposition, literally. But however, the gladiators.
The Iraqi army didn't attack you. It just fired a few.
No, they fired artillery, but they were about 30,000 strong. They were on the verge.
Why didn't they just move in on you?
What?
Why didn't they just attack you?
Well, A, because the gladiators were keeping them at bay, basically. Or the guys were bombing and strafing. That was one thing. The first night, no, the second night, I think it was, we had a detachment of the Queen's Own QOSB, like something like infantry. A detachment there, plus the Iraqi levies, who we didn't know whose side were, that they did a sortie out, and that wasn't the first. Let me just go back a bit. I'd mentioned the two guns which stood at the entrance to the station headquarters. There was an army artillery sergeant who was walking past these and looked at them, because we had no artillery, and he decided that they could be made to work. So they scraped the paint off, and the breech mechanism was in perfect condition. But we didn't have any ammunition, so he sent for some ammunition to India, and they flew the ammunition in, actually. It must have been about the first week, actually. But then they hitched these onto the back of a 1500 way and went out at night into the desert and opened up on the Iraqi army at close range. It took them by surprise, and plus the fact that they were being demoralised by the air attacks, and they eventually, the army, British army and the levies, they made an airborne landing on Fallujah Plain. Fallujah Plain, and captured this Fallujah Bridge, which is a big key point. And by that time, we had knocked out most of the artillery. It must have been about the first 3 or 4 days. There was spasmodic firing from the 4.5 howitzers. We couldn't find them, actually. So we put an aircraft up at night and watched for the flashes. It was quite effective, and then they went and sorted them out the following day. And eventually they sorted the guns out. But the culminating feature was that the Iraqi army, for some reason, decided to withdraw. And they had a whole bus convoy in the vicinity of Fallujah, which is only about 5 miles away. And they were loading the troops in these buses and bussing them off. Whereupon the gladiators from our flight fell upon them, as the phrase goes. And we could see them attacking these buses from the camp where we were based. They were firing at these buses, and there was like 4 rods of silver, because that was the traces. And they were really played havoc with these convoys, and they really slaughtered a lot of the army. The pilot said that the guns were so effective that they were cutting the bus in half. So that was really a good pat on the back for us. But then eventually, the administration went ahead, and the force which was coming up from Egypt, the air headquarters of Egypt, was told forcibly by Ministry of Defence to send a relief column, which took 10 days. They had to assemble it and then get it out. Anyway, eventually arrived, but by which time it arrived, we had suppressed the opposition, literally suppressed it. The Air Force had suppressed it. And we were just sort of waiting for additional strength. But at that juncture, we had lost 7 guys killed in action on our course, who had been flying as air gunners, and force landed in the desert, been murdered by the local Arabs. They said, well, we'll carry on with the flying training. So they mustered all the serviceable aircraft, and one of the last trips was had to fly in Oxford out to Egypt, but they posted to 71-80.
Did the flying training start up again after all this?
Oh yeah. But they were dispersed, obviously, because when we left ferrying our aircraft, which was June, the whole confrontation went on a month. From commencement of hostilities was March to May, and then in June, May the 31st, on the 2nd of June we flew our aircraft, serviceable aircraft, out to Egypt, Abu Swer.
And that would be your next posting, would it, I presume?
Yeah, that was the end of it. But the point about the confrontation, as I said, it was pretty hard. We worked very hard, all the daylight hours. The food was maintained for most of the time, but then we were under bully beef and hardtack, literally, for best part of 3 weeks, waiting on the Iraqi civilians who were working in the Iraqi Air Force were evacuated on the first day back to us and flown out by Dakota to somewhere else. I don't remember where they went. Together with the king had already gone, actually. And then near the end of the exercise, about 3 weeks, the relief force arrived, but they pressed on. They laid up at Habaniya to get themselves re-equipped and re-victualled and whatever they had to do before they went down to Baghdad to take over in Baghdad proper. There had been one or two abortive attempts to relieve the embassy, but the Iraqis stormed the embassy and pinched the radio, so there was little or no communication with the embassy in Baghdad. Don't quite know what happened to the embassy. I mean, he was probably let go. But it's quite an there is a book about it called The War That Never Was, written by Vice Marshal Dudgeon. He happened to be our chief flying instructor. And then the other part of the book is called, oh dear, Something Victory.
Doesn't matter.
I can't remember what it's called. Oh, well, I've got it there. But it was a history of the, in detail of the, because he was there all the time. He had been the CO, Dudgeon, who was the chief flying instructor, had been the CO of 55 Squadron in the desert, had been moved up to Banya for rest till it expired, and he did more operations at Banya, I think. But we, as I said, on 2nd of June, we flew our aircraft out. I'm not sure about the single-engine people. I suppose they didn't fly theirs out. They probably just left them.
Anything about the flight? It was quite a long flight. Anything about that flight to Abu Swer?
Well, it was a long flight. Quite a long flight. 4 hours... 7 hours 50. Well, it staged through Lida, which is now airport for Jerusalem. 4:50 to Lida, and then now 55 from Lida to Abu Swer. That was dropped, yeah. So that was quite. While Habania was under siege, on the 11th of April, I went as second pilot, oblique stroke navigator, in Valencia of 70 Squadron, down to do the routine run down to Egypt from Habania. And that took us 9.5 hours. We went via, that was in Valencia, one of his my troop carriers, Rukbar, Lida, that was, and Heliopolis. And then when I got there, we were brought to readiness because of the evacuation of Tobruk. We had to stay there from 11th of April to the 15th of April, 41. Is that right? 41? Yeah.
Did you do any evacuating or?
No, I didn't actually. I got into trouble with the MPs there. And my sergeant had to come and bail me out. I was still a corporal, right? I was an air gunner. No, I tell a lie. I got my wings, and I was wearing a Distinguished Flying Medal, and the local MPs didn't like that at all. They apprehended me, but. I said, well, I'm authorized, etc., etc. I've come down, etc., etc. And so Sergeant Clements had to come and put a good word in for me in the guard room.
Had they treated you badly? Or
well, they didn't treat me badly. They didn't like the idea that they thought I was masquerading as a pilot. Full stop. Which is, they were, I suppose, entitled. They didn't accept my explanation.